are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, was this small-town TV repairman a harmless eccentric or a bizarre killer? For the first time, Alvin Ridley's own defense attorney reveals the inside story of his case and trial in an extraordinary tale of friendship and an idealistic young attorney's quest to clear his client's name, and in the process, rebuild his own life. In October 1997, the town of Ringgold in northwest Georgia was shaken by reports of a murder in its midst. A dead woman was found in Alvin Ridley's house, and even more shockingly, she was the wife no one knew he had. McCracken Poston had been a state representative before he lost his bid for U.S. Congress and returned to his law career. Alvin Ridley was a local character who once sold and serviced Zenith televisions. Though reclusive and an outsider, the Zenith man, as Poston knew him, hardly seemed capable of murder. Alvin was a difficult client, storing evidence in a cockroach-infested suitcase, unwilling to reveal key facts to his defender. Gradually, Poston pieced together the full story behind Virginia and Alvin's curious marriage and her cause of death, which was completely overlooked by law enforcement. Calling on medical experts, testimony from Alvin himself, and a wealth of surprising evidence gleaned from Alvin's junk-strewn house, Poston presented a groundbreaking defense that allowed Alvin to return to his peculiar lifestyle, a free man. Years after his trial, Alvin was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, a revelation that sheds light on much of his lifelong personal battle and shows how easily those who don't fit societal norms can be castigated and misunderstood. Part true crime, part courtroom drama, and full of local color, Zenith Man is also the moving story of an unexpected friendship between two very different men that changed and perhaps saved the lives of both. The book that we're featuring this evening is Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom, with my special guest, attorney and author, McCracken Poston Jr. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, McCracken Poston Jr.
I'm so glad to be here with you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this fascinating book, Zenith Man.
Thank you. It was a labor of love. Took me over two decades to form the book in my head to finally write it. A lot of your listeners are going to be familiar with the case because it has been, over the years, featured and reran on Forensic Files. The episode is called Killigraphy, of the kind of a play on the word kill and the word calligraphy.
Right.
And then on A&E's American Justice, an episode called Death in a Small Town. On NPR's Snap Judgment, an episode called The Writing on the Wall.
Now, you talk about October 4th, 1997, right away, just in the prologue. And so you say that people are familiar with this story. And you write that they are familiar with a portion of a 911 call, which brings everybody the attention of this international attention to this story. So you say that he, Alvin Ridley, lived in his late parents' house on Inman Street. He was a failed television repairman and the town boogeyman. He left his house and drove past the local fire department staffed with ambulance and EMTs and drove looking for a workable payphone. Speculation is he called a funeral home to retrieve a dead body, but he did call. It was confirmed Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but he is instructed that it is a matter for the Catoosa County authorities. And so reluctantly, you write, he calls 911 and the Catoosa County 911 office is right across the street and says something to the effect that his wife breathing. And he says, I don't think so. So tell us about this 911 call and what the public hears and a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved in this extraordinary case.
Thank you, Dan. First, Ringgold, Georgia is a relatively small town. It has around 5,000 citizens in it. Catoosa County has in the 60,000 in number. We are a part of metropolitan area of Chattanooga, Tennessee. We are on the Georgia-Tennessee border on the Georgia side. It's a very historic area from the American Civil War. The Battle of Chickamauga happened on the west side of the county. Ringgold was named for a Mexican-American war hero that, as far as I know, never set foot here. He happened to die at a time when the penny press had been developed, and so he was kind of a mass media hero with a heroic death at the Battle of Palo Alto. And so Ringgold, really, over the years, and definitely since the Civil War, it kind of took a very small town approach. It didn't grow much more. We're mainly known for the place that Dolly Parton and Carl Dean got married in 1966.
Okay.
And 3 weeks later, Alvin Ridley and young Virginia Hickey got their marriage license. Now, this was in 1966. In 1997, I was a somewhat down on my luck, defeated congressional candidate. Found myself back home with little prospects of any political appointment or electoral chances. I was trying to put my life back together and revive a moribund law practice. And suddenly this thing happened on October 4th of 1997 that kind of sent shockwaves through the small town. One, everybody knew who Alvin Ridley was. He was a malcontent. I think it would be a not too much of a stretch to call him that. He was constantly suing local officials. He posted missives on the inside of his shuttered and padlocked Zenith TV dealership that was falling apart, had a giant hole in the roof. His life just seemed to have fallen apart in the early 80s. And he had a lot of people he was blaming for that. And he would post these diatribes on the inside of the glass, so you couldn't move them. But he would often name people who he thought were responsible for his ills. So when he called the 911 call on the morning of October 4, 1997, which was a Saturday, everyone noticed a very flat effect of his voice. He just sounded, as a matter of fact, my wife's not breathing.
Right.
And there was just not a lot of emotion in his voice. And even though at the end of the call, he said, please hurry, again in a somewhat non-excited voice, the 911 tape went around the world as, here's a guy calling in for 911 who does not sound very excited. And who is this woman? Nobody in town, or at least not a lot of people in town, knew that she even existed, much less the fact that she had been his wife for 32 years. So Virginia's family, or what was left of them, were siblings. Her mother at the time was in a rest home. They picked up the mantle that Virginia's parents had started back in the late 1960s of saying, well, she's been kept against her will. And that evolved into being kept in the basement against her will for 30 years. So you can imagine how that went over with the investigating authorities. And so they began to ask a lot more probing questions to Alvin Ridley.
And you write about your interactions with this gentleman and the interactions with your father, and your father had known Alvin as well and the family. Tell us just a little bit about your background with Alvin.
Well, Alvin had gone to high school with my oldest sister. I was born the beginning of their senior year, so I had no real direct memory of him. But I knew that he had a TV shop in Ringgold. My father traded with him, and my father was the kind of guy who always tried to get the best deals and a lot of times would interact with people who were not in the highest echelons of society. It was just the way my father was. He was a very kind and understanding man. However, he had a drinking problem, and it wasn't your stereotypical Southern drunk and a wife beater. He was a very kind, sad man who had a serious alcohol problem, but he was very high functioning. He worked in a foundry in Chattanooga and raised six children, allowing my mother to stay at home and have a garden and raised us all very well, except for the fact of, you know, having an alcoholic parent. My first early memory of Alvin, and I was only reminded of this during the representation, but I was about 13 or so and was watching live wrestling on television. I had long worn off the tuner knob, and we were using a pair of pliers to turn the channels between the three channels out of Chattanooga. And suddenly this strange man is in my living room. My mother had just waved him in, and he has got a new knob for our TV. But he takes the opportunity to give me a lecture of how to turn the channels on a TV.
Right.
And I only remembered it because he noted that I was watching wrestling, and he mentioned that he had in Chattanooga at the venue where the wrestling happened up there, that he had met Andre the Giant.
Right.
I remember telling my friends at school, I met this strange guy who says he met Andre the Giant, and Andre the Giant allegedly told him what he had for breakfast every morning, which was like a dozen eggs or a couple of dozen eggs, you know, a couple of loaves of bread or something like that. But
sure.
I remember telling that story, like I've met somebody who met Andre the Giant. I didn't think of it again until I'm having a conversation now with a man I'm advising who is about to be charged with murder and about to be accused of holding his wife captive for 30 years in the basement. And he mentions that he has met Andre the Giant and what Andre the Giant had for breakfast. And I thought, you're that guy. You're that guy that I talked to when I was 13. And you told me that because I went and told it at school. And so it was interesting because early on, our conversations were not that pleasant. Early on, Alvin was extremely difficult. He would call me at night, yelling at me, insisting that I'm using air quotes here, knock his case out because it was, in his opinion, a wrongfully brought case, and that he really wanted me to look into ancient civil litigation that dealt with his father's car wreck, the counterclaim judgment against him that caused the county to seize a van that he owned, and all of these things that I had to promise to look into them just to get him to cooperate with me on the murder case. He would say, for example, I would say, Alvin, we can't talk about your van. This is a murder case. And he would say, well, yes, we can, because I didn't kill her, but they did take my van.
Yeah.
So he was hell-bent on kneecapping any real effort to represent him on what became a murder case.
You say, too, he was in a pitiful state with the sagging, filthy clothes and just horrible hygiene.
He seemed to have a mental state that he relished in needing the sympathy and sometimes financial help of others. He went to a number of churches where he would make his plea, and many of them helped him. And many of them then wrote letters saying, hey, don't come back here asking for any more money for your mother's roof. We've given you plenty to fix it. So there was something going on with him because I think he was very sincere, but he could come off as a con man if you didn't look at him deeply enough.
You write about June 29th, 1998, and you're talking to a friend in law enforcement, and he breaks the news about Alvin Ridley being arrested.
It was actually a tire dealer that was excited about the fact that Alvin had just been arrested in his parking lot, pulled over and arrested there when the young officer, Johnny Gass, recognized him. What had happened, in most cases, there's a suspect, there's an arrest, and then the news springs from there. In this case, was not like that. Alvin was a suspect, but not directly one, or it didn't seem to be direct, because there was no more questioning of him within a week of his wife's death. But there was a kind of a drawn out process with Virginia's autopsy. And then there was a special presentment to the grand jury, which none of us knew about. And then once the grand jury true billed an indictment, then Alvin was a wanted man. He and I had talked for weeks, and finally had just come to the conclusion of there may not be any charges brought. So let's just have this understanding that let me know if they bring charges, or I'll be monitoring. If I ever hear you're arrested, I'll come to you. And of course, when I heard it that day, I did go to him at the county jail.
You also write that the National Enquirer has headlines, and you include it: sicko holds wife hostage for 30 years, then kills her.
Yeah, I think it was the National Examiner, which is the same ilk of tabloid. And of course, that just spread like wildfire throughout the world. Before you knew it, we had German film crews in town, everybody titillated by the notion that a woman was held against her will in a basement for decades, three decades, and then was killed. Early on, from the first 911 call, Alvin informed the authorities that his wife had epilepsy. He maintained throughout all of the questioning that she had had what he called a spell.
Sure.
By that, he meant a seizure. She had, from childhood, severe epilepsy. The authorities were under the assumption that she was not given medication. And thanks to Alvin being a pack rat and never throwing anything away, we were able to dispel that.
You include that in this sensational coverage in the press, they also said that the investigation may include the exhumation of Alvin's mother, Minnie Ridley. So just adding to more controversy and speculation about the horrors that went on behind these closed doors.
Alvin had gotten into it with social services, and this was at the height of he and his mother's litigation over his father's car accident, and they kind of caused it themselves. Alvin's mother wrote to social services declaring that her husband had died and that they're having trouble maintaining their lawsuit, and that her husband promised her a refrigerator and two new dresses, and she really is in a bad way. Well,
right.
When a state agency gets something like that, they want to investigate. So innocently enough, they start wanting to investigate. But Alvin and his mother really took that as a government intrusion on their privacy. And there was a race to Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga across jurisdictional state line where his mother ended up, and his mother told the doctors, they need to leave us alone. I want to be with my son. And of course, nobody was mentioning Virginia. And in the back of every agency's mind, when they went to the Ridley house over the years, a lot of times it was just an effort to flush out Virginia.
Right.
And because she had been missing since the 1968. So there was a lot of years and years and years of speculation about where is she and what is she doing and why isn't she talking to her family. So ultimately, you know, Alvin and his mother kind of got the better of the state officials, and they just kind of shrugged their shoulders and resigned from trying to find his mother. Now, and I'm talking about his mother, Minnie Ridley. So when Virginia died, it kind of stirred up those memories from just 4 years before of them trying to gain access to his mother. But his mother was quite complicit in evading the Georgia authorities, as evidenced by her statements to the doctors in Chattanooga.
You write about the difficulty in dealing with Alvin, but one of the main things that you had issue with is that you wanted to get inside the house and examine things that he had allowed the authorities to do previous. Tell us about your frustration in this regard.
It could not be explained. From the day I got him out of jail, And he told me his story that his wife just didn't want to get out. I told him, I said, I need to photograph this house. And you have to understand, this house has probably never been painted since the late 1940s when it was built by his father. And it looks it. But at the same time, that means there's nothing covered up. There's no bars on the windows. There's no padlock latches or any evidence of someone being held captive there. And I wanted to capture that.
Sure.
And I wanted to capture photos inside the house, you know, showing Virginia's things and things like that. He just simply would not let me. He would say, I'll think about it. And this went on for over a year. Meanwhile, I reminded him that he let every law enforcement officer that ever asked him for access, he let them in. So from starting to advise him on October 6, 1997, until November of 1998, I was denied access to this house. At some point, I even purchased and installed a telephone for his house.
Right.
Because since I had been in the state legislature, my cell phone has been Atlanta-based, and I wanted him to be able to call me and not have to go out to a phone booth on some noisy road to call me, where he inevitably ended up being frustrated and yelling at me. So I was purchasing a phone for his house. Now, I went there with the phone installer and my camera, excited about getting in to his home. And Alvin realized that and decided, oh no, we're just going to put the phone on the porch. So he had the phone installed on the porch and thwarting me again. So in November of 1998, on Thanksgiving Day, my new bride and I went to visit her family in one part of the county. And then we visited my family in Graysville in the northern part of the county. And on the way out, my parents handed me a plate of food covered up in foil and several little margarine tubs full of other parts of the meal. And they said, my father said, I want you to take this to Alvin Ridley. He doesn't have anyone. And that is the last place I wanted to be on Thanksgiving.
Right.
The trial had been put off the month before. And I was so thankful of that. But there was starting to be some evidence that was coming our way, I thought. For one, the autopsy of Virginia Ridley revealed that she was covered in these tiny ruptured blood vessels called petechia or petechial hemorrhages. And the state of Georgia was saying that's indicative of asphyxiation death. And so we had a great dean of our defense bar in close to my community, a man named Bobby Lee Cook,
right,
who, if you'll do some research, you'll learn that the Matlock character was based on him.
Right.
Well, he was just down the road and he had known me since before I was a lawyer. And I went to him because he has this beautiful library. And I said, you know, I've got this case. I really want to see some books, some pathology books, because I've got this thing about petechial hemorrhages and I want to see them. And he gives me like four forensic pathology books. And I said, well, please let me copy these. And he said, no, just keep them. Just keep them as long as you need them. And I began to realize in my research that petechial hemorrhaging was quite common, even among the living, of people after having a seizure or having a coughing fit, or in cases of asphyxiation as well. But it did happen in non-manual strangulation and or manual smothering deaths as well. And so I was very excited about that. But there was no real, other than in these books, I really wanted another death that was clearly a seizure-related death. And amazingly and sadly and tragically, one kind of landed in our laps in September of 1998. The just heralded Olympic star Florence Griffith Joyner passed away unexpectedly. She was known as FloJo. She was the greatest female athlete of all time. But I didn't think anything of it until October, about the third week of October, when on the news one night, I heard that her autopsy had been released and that they determined she died of a seizure disorder. So I was on the phone with Orange County, California medical examiner the next business day.
Right.
And talked to the doctor that actually autopsied Florence Griffith Joyner and convinced them to share that autopsy with me. And what was fascinating was the similarities. But I knew that FloJo, definitely the greatest female athlete in the world and one of the most known people in the world, that her autopsy was going to be first class. And I wanted to compare it to perhaps the least known woman in the world, Virginia Ridley. So that was encouraging. So I had that going on in October, and we needed an epilepsy expert to describe that, yes, people do and can die of epilepsy, and then also to explain these petechial hemorrhages and how they very often happen to people after seizures. So that was all I had. But in November, I show up with the turkey plate on late Thanksgiving Day. I had taken my then wife home and came back, and I didn't call Alvin. I just went. And one thing I was beginning to realize about Alvin was he was very transactional. And had I known that all along, it would have been a much easier representation. But I was figuring it out. And I knocked on the door, and he comes to the door, and I said, "Alvin, my parents wanted you to have Thanksgiving meal." And he said, "Just a minute." He closes the door, and I think I hear him talking to somebody inside, and the TV is running, and everything goes quiet. And he opens the door, and he says, "Come in." Well, it was a fascinating and yet uncomfortable place, just in terms of the lack of good ventilation. And of course, it was late fall, and it was sealed up pretty tight and had some warming attempts to, you know, insulate windows with the blankets, you know, tacked over them.
Yeah.
There was a single red Christmas light bulb illuminating this main room of the house. And I recognized from the photos, there's the bed, the deathbed of Virginia Ridley.
Right.
It was in the corner up against the wall immediately on the left when I walked in. But he pulled a string and there was a bigger light bulb, a regular white light bulb. And, you know, as I was talking to him, I noticed I didn't have a camera and I was not prepared, but I noticed a whole wall of paper that was tacked, taped, nailed, wedged in paneling, just any way you could attach a piece of paper to a wall. They just about every way they were attached. And I was having difficulty reading them because it was very dark in the house. And with this light on, my head was making a giant shadow on them. So I was trying to get up and get kind of sideways and look where I could read them. And they appeared to be all written in the same hand. And it was a very distinctive handwriting. The lower reaches of letters that had the lower stems, and it had a real flourish on it. And, you know, I said, "There's a recipe. Here's a poem. Here's some discussion about events." And I said, "Alvin," I knew it was not his handwriting because I'd seen that scribble. So I just said, "Alvin, who wrote this?" And he said, "Well, Virginia did." Well, I got so excited, probably too excited for his liking. And then I said, "Alvin, I got to have this. This is the everyday mundane record. Many of these things are of this woman that no one has seen in 30 years. And I need this." And he said, "Well, you can't have it. It's all I've got left of her." And so we were back to this, this real stalemate that he and I almost constantly maintained about the things that I wanted him to do. And so, Alvin professed and seemed to be a very religious person. I found out fairly early in the representation, accidentally, that I could stop his crying if he thought I was praying.
Right.
And when I say crying, I mean his rage or his yelling at me or his complaints about me, that if I just began a prayer, he would get very reverent he would listen to the prayer, and I began to basically give my advice in prayer form to him. Oh, Lord, please explain to Alvin why I need to get in his house. Please explain to Alvin why he needs to help me talk about his wife, and there'll be another day to talk about them taking his van, you know, those kind of things. But it was a way to control him, and it was a way that he was too polite, too religious to fight it. It was helpful. So I went right into a prayer right in that room and, you know, said, "Dear Lord, you have given me all this evidence." And I said, "Is there more?" And Alvin goes, "Yeah, in there." And in this other room is just box and box and box of her correspondence.
Wow.
And her journal, her loose leaf diary. I later, after going through it all and pulling what I thought would be helpful to him, I estimated there were probably 15,000 plus entries.
Wow.
And much of it was dated. And I tried to pull all of that. And then some of it was dated by what it was talking about. The moon landings, elections. Alvin and Virginia had early on been evicted from public housing. In fact, that was the last place she had ever been seen in public, was at that trial of their eviction. And she only showed up because the judge ordered her there and went back into chambers with her parents and later emerged. And she went home with Alvin and her parents went home. So she obviously convinced the judge that she was where she wanted to be. And that was September 15, 1970, the last time Virginia Ridley had ever been seen. So 27 years later, she's dead. And I'm trying to put together this defense. And I have suddenly found all these writings that indicate that she seemed to be a happy person. She was watched a lot of TV. She noted different programs that she liked. She seemed to like the real wholesome stuff, like The Waltons, which was a CBS show that was all family oriented. She was absolutely obsessed with TV's Ron Howard, mm-hmm. who was on the Andy Griffith Show as Opie, who was on Happy Days as Richie, and who later became quite a prolific writer and director and producer. And she was obsessed with him, but in a kind of a wholesome way. She took out clippings about him from newspapers, and she wrote on the edge, "Ron Howard and his wife, Cheryl." And I actually introduced that one to show the jury that this woman was even plugged into popular culture. And she wrote President Nixon. And that was evidenced by a person from the HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, who wrote her back referencing her letter to President Richard M. Nixon. So she was, she wrote congressmen, senators. Alvin and Virginia had, for every ounce of suspicion they had about local government, there was a pound of hope in federal government and federal agencies. And that later revealed itself with some of Alvin's behaviors as I've tried to represent him.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, we have to get to this indictment and this trial. And first, what is Alvin charged with? And then can you lay out, as you do, this person that you knew previously, this attorney named, nicknamed Buzz, tell us about how he lays out the case for the prosecution.
Well, with all the rumors, I was expecting a false imprisonment charge because that was the absolute rumors of human captivity. And that's what, of course, caused all the international fervor. I mean, think about it. We're a pretty sick country because that's all anybody was interested in is this woman who's kept in a basement against her will. And it's, you know, it's a shocking allegation.
Sure.
But what he ended up indicting Alvin for was malice murder and then felony murder, meaning maybe he didn't have the intent to kill her, but he was assaulting her. So that's the third ground, was aggravated assault with his hands. And either way, if you didn't find malice, you could have found him guilty of felony murder by way of aggravated assault. And so I thought it interesting that the allegation of false imprisonment did not make it in. But then my friend Buzz, who is a friend and who was very serious in his effort, and he filed a notice to put in evidence of the false imprisonment of not only Virginia Ridley, but of Alvin's mother, Minnie Ridley. And then there was a very disturbing allegation about Alvin's cats. There was a 1993 Department of Aging report where they went in looking to see Alvin's mother, and they noted, you know, some conditions of the house. And then they also noted there are two cats tied to the coffee table. Well, 4 years later, they're going in to retrieve the body of Virginia Ridley and responding to that 911 call. And one of the EMT notes, there are two cats tied to the coffee table. And so when I saw that, I thought, oh my God, this is weird. And I talked to Alvin, I said, what is this about cats tied to the coffee table? And he says, well, when I'm bringing stuff in and out of the house, or people are coming in and out of the house, which I understood was hardly ever, that was the way to keep the cats from running outside the house. As Alvin said, mama didn't want them having no babies. Well, I knew for a fact that if I got one cat lover on the jury, that he was gone. And so I told him, I said, we have to get these cats to the vet, because when I saw the cats, they appeared fine, but it was very dark. I couldn't really see them. I explained to him that, you know, that's something that could hurt us. Please let me get them to the vet. And of course, the last day I could possibly add the vet as a witness, Alvin comes to the office wondering why aren't we going to the vet? So bottom line is, we got the cats to the vet. They ended up being in good health. There were no markings around their neck indicating that they were not tied very often by the little twine leashes. And I even went out to a pet store and bought a cat leash just so in case that evidence got in, I could tell a jury, while none of us really think of leashing a cat, it happens. And people take their cats on walks sometimes. But in any event, for this really funny episode of taking these cats to the vet's testimony, proffered testimony, was these cats are in pretty good health, and one of them is 22 years old. And so that, in a pretrial hearing, resulted in a ruling by the court that there should be no cat evidence coming in, and there should be no Mama Minnie Ridley evidence coming in either. So we kept that stuff out. So as long as nobody put Alvin's good character into evidence, we should be able to keep that out.
I couldn't believe repeatedly it was remarkable that this cat issue was an issue at all and included in part of the prosecution's allegations, let alone the allegation of Alvin's mother being held hostage to absolutely nothing to these allegations whatsoever.
I think that they just wanted to make him out more weird, and they just assumed that weird equaled guilty.
Sure. Let's get to really what the prosecution's case was based on, was Dr. Hellman and Coroner Hollander, and also the things that were said to Coroner Hollander. So what was the supposed cause of death, and what was their theory as to the circumstances in this homicide?
Well, the death certificate said homicide, and the notion was soft strangulation and or smothering. Alvin indicated all along that his wife had a seizure that night, that she appeared to be fine when he went back to sleep. But when he woke up, she had turned over and was on her face on the bed and non-responsive. Alvin attempted what just ended up being a pitiful effort at CPR. He didn't know what CPR stood for. He just had seen, to the degree that any of us that have never had CPR training, just seeing it on TV, I guess. He tried doing things to her to revive her, but they were few and far between sufficient enough to revive her. So the allegation was that he had soft strangled or smothered her. Well, that's similar to epilepsy death face down in a bed where you seize and you really can't get enough oxygen in if you're seizing face down. On a bed, your airways are blocked. And so that was our theory. And part of the state's allegation was, well, he, you know, she died because there was not enough care. Well, fortunately for Alvin, Virginia's writings explained everything. And I spent a week going through them and tagging things that were important. For example, in a Bible, she wrote a date in September of 1977 in which she declared she's not going to take her medicine anymore. God's going to take care of her. Well, thanks to Alvin being a PAP rat, I had years of empty epilepsy medicine bottles leading up to September of 1977, when there were bottles for a few months after where there were full medicine bottles. So the indication was that Alvin was continuing to get her medication for her. At some point, Virginia stopped going to the doctor. For some reason, the doctor started putting the epilepsy medication in Alvin's name, probably because he wasn't seeing Virginia anymore because of her mandate that she wasn't getting out. But she had the medicine, you know, to take, but she obviously stopped taking it. And she lived 20 years and 1 month non-medicating. But I think it set her up for the classic sudden death and epilepsy death.
In that regard, the sudden death during epilepsy, what did you determine with Florence Joyner?
Well, the FloJo had a seizure disorder that not a lot of people knew about. It explained why she didn't run in the Atlanta 96 Olympics. I actually saw her from a distance there because she was a superstar. And, you know, I was disappointed that I didn't get to see her run, but I think it was because she was dealing with these issues. So, but the petechial hemorrhages were around the eyes. They can be around the mouth and the soft tissue areas, even on other parts of the body, from the intense internal pressure and blood flow that's going on during a seizure. So her autopsy supported the notion that if she died with this first class autopsy, if she died of a seizure disorder, then it was an easy call to say that Virginia Ridley died of a seizure disorder. So, you know, I was confident about that because, and I had given a copy to the DA and he had prepped Dr. Hellman. Dr. Hellman was trying to split hairs and say, well, no, it's different. Virginia's type of petechia happens when somebody does CPR too hard or manually asphyxiate them. And the problem is that the coroner was brand new, and she is a wonderful person who later went on to be quite a effective coroner, really concentrating on stopping drug deaths. But at the time, she was new, and she delivered the body to the state crime lab in Atlanta with a statement. And the statement was, this woman has been kept captive in her basement for 15 to 20 years. Well, in my opinion, and I argued that that put the notion in Dr. Hellman's mind that I'm sure he killed her. If anybody who would keep somebody locked up for that long, it's an easy stretch to think they could kill her. And so I think that influenced that decision with him. And we had this wonderful epilepsy expert out of South Carolina named Braxton Bryant Wanamaker. I found him online, and this is early internet. I had to write down URLs by hand and then try to remember and try to type them in by hand later. And I've still got those handwritten URLs that I would find the journals, medical journals online about sudden death and epilepsy. His name kept popping up, so I contacted him and I retained him because I wanted him to talk about petechial hemorrhages in his clients. Well, what's fascinating is before I put him on, because I was paying him by the hour, so I brought him down the night before, put him in a hotel, took him to dinner, and that's where my newlywed bride and I treated him to dinner. And it was a very difficult conversation just because he was so smart and I didn't know anything about his subject matter, but I was learning as much as I could. But just as an aside, as we were finishing dinner, he said, is there anything else unusual about this person, this woman? And I laughed and I said, she could not even burp or anything without writing it down. And he said, oh, that's hypergraphia. And I, you could have picked me up off the floor.
Right.
I had a reason now for this obsessive writing that she did, because quite frankly, it worried me a little bit. I'm just thinking, you know, why would somebody write all the time unless they, you know, just constantly. He said he had patients that would bring him journals thinking that he would want to read them. And he said they're just mundane reports of things that are going on in their lives. And that was a huge break, because it explained it. It's often adjacent to epilepsy,
right?
Particularly temporal lobe epilepsy. And and I need to tell you too, that Virginia had trouble over the years with having bad reactions to her epilepsy medicine, and think that could have very well influenced her decision to stop taking them. And as to her agoraphobia, it was obvious, but she seemed pretty happy in her existence with first Alvin's mother and father and Alvin, and then slowly just Alvin. She was quite a reporter of things that are going on from their perspective. And I suspect that she was the brains behind some of Alvin's litigation.
Sure.
I found glossaries that she would write to explain legal terms, I think, explaining to Alvin. It was fascinating, because she was definitely the more religious of the two, and she filled 5 Bibles in the margins with her writings, and it was just fascinating. I had one known writing of hers, and a handwriting analyst will want a government certified example, at least one, so that they could say this is a known writing of her. It happened in a government office, or it happened in on a sworn affidavit or something like that. And then they compare it to the question documents. Well, I couldn't afford to get all of them checked out, but I just sent a bunch of samples to Brian Carney in Atlanta, who was a handwriting analyst that I knew of. And he came back with a conclusion that they were clearly the writing of Virginia Ridley. Had Alvin do exemplars to exclude him, also had known writing examples of Bill and Minnie Ridley, Alvin's parents, to eliminate them as well.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop, hear these messages. Now let's get to, you write early on that when you get the advice from your counsel friend, your attorney friend, his father had also been one of your mentors, in that he had discovered something in your discovery. And as always, what he had said is that you can win this case as long as you don't put Alvin on the stand.
He listened to my cross-examination of Dr. Hellman. And my cross-examination of Dr. Hellman took a whole day. And finally, toward the end, Dr. Hellman conceded, yes, she could have had a seizure, but I still think Alvin killed her, basically. And that was huge, because that was an admission that this woman, that's reasonable doubt. And so Renzo Wiggins, who gave me my first job out of law school in his family firm, he also had a case where Dr. Hellman was going to be a witness. So he was taking very close notes, and he offered his notes to me, and I thanked him. And he said, you know, I think you've got this thing won, just as long as you keep Alvin off the stand. And that was kind of a joke between us, because we both knew of Alvin. We both knew that he would want to talk about the county taking his van and not his dead wife. So I was confident at that point, but that was before the next day. The most engaged I ever saw Alvin about this case was when I would go online and looking up forensic pathologists. And Alvin was suddenly engaged in the case. He was interested in a forensic pathologist, and I had to spell it every time I brought it up. And he would pull out a wadded up, folded up piece of paper out of his pocket, and he would dutifully write down FORENSIC pathologist. And it was getting really old, but Alvin seemed interested, and he said, I want to get one. I want him to see the house. And I thought, well, you know, if I can keep Alvin this engaged, it'll be well worth the brief expense of a forensic pathologist. So This is 1998, Dan. Man. The internet now, I think people would be a lot more skeptical of things that they just find on the internet. But I was green and wet behind the ears still of newborn to the internet. And I found this person in Georgia who had a fantastic website for 1998. It had some music. It had some 16-bit animation. It was a forensic pathologist. And I thought, hey, this is great. They're in Georgia. Alvin's engaged. He's excited.
Right.
Alvin kept saying, I want him to come to my house, and didn't realize why. But I went ahead and hired this guy. He and I went to the crime lab and looked at was preserved of Virginia Ridley, which is mostly tongue and throat, where there was nothing remarkable. The hyoid bone was indicated as intact, which very often in strangulation cases, it's a very delicate bone. And not all, but I would say most serious strangulation cases, it's broken. And so that just, I wasn't impressed with compared, having seen Florence Griffith Joyner's autopsy, which was extensive, you know, they didn't even preserve a lot of the brain of Virginia Ridley although there was clear indications in the written autopsy, the dictated autopsy, of issues of a seizure disorder. So in any event, this guy went with me to the handwriting analyst's house as well. And he was grilling my handwriting analyst, Brian Carney. And I thought, this is very odd. And then we get in the car and he offers to be a handwriting analyst too.
Right.
And I said, nah, it's okay. I got that covered. Well, by the time he comes up to testify the next day, I learned what Alvin's plans are. Alvin has retrieved an ancient mannequin from his basement, and he's created a non-crime scene, if you will, where he's showing how Virginia was in the bed. And this is a very difficult house. And I think we really frightened this guy.
Sure.
This doctor. So we didn't get to spend a lot of quality time with him, but I put him up the next day because the state had made a big deal over the fact that one side of the bed seemed to have a depression in it and the other did not, indicating that only one person was sleeping in that bed and that Virginia likely was locked in the basement. Well, Virginia was a very small, light person, but at the same time, this bed was up against a corner of the room and it also served as a sofa, if you will. So people sat on the edge of the bed to watch TV, and it was clear. It was clear that was the case. So I wanted this, and I'm using air quotes, forensic pathologist to just note that for when I put him on the stand the next day. Well, turns out that my friend Buzz, the DA, was ready for this guy. The witness that I put on the stand as a forensic pathologist, I did not vet very closely. As it turned out, he was not licensed anywhere in the United States to do what he claimed he did. He was educated in the Dominican Republic, nothing against that, but that's the only place that he was licensed at the time. He just kind of was coming off as a bit of a fraud. Mm-hmm. Although I think he was very sincere. He belonged to a group out of, I think, Philadelphia called the Vidocq Society.
Right.
It seems very exclusive, and they only let like 82 people in it at a time. And it explained that it's kind of a crowdsourcing, if you will, of experts. And that's one of the reasons he was asking the handwriting analysis so many questions, because they kind of assumed knowledge of several different disciplines. And so it was a disaster. Buzz destroyed him. Mm-hmm. And it was just a low point in the case. Well, we went to lunch, and I put Alvin and this other character in this book that you read about named Salesman Sam. I put them in one booth. Alvin had some church of his latest church, some followers that were with him. So I thought, I'm just going to let them eat there. I'm going to eat over here. I'll get the bill. Well, somehow during lunch, I missed Jesus appearing.
Yeah.
And telling Alvin that he had to testify. And Alvin breaks this to me on the way back to the courthouse. And I was horrified because As far as I knew, all Alvin wanted to talk about was the county taking his van in 1984.
Sure.
And not his wife. I realized that Alvin was very literal. I had found that he was very transactional. At some point, I was paying him to let me use her evidence. I was paying him for cooperation. I bought tombstones for his mother, father, wife, and him.
Incredible.
Because they didn't have them. And I was doing it to get his cooperation. So, you know, it's his right as a defendant to testify.
Sure.
But I wanted to prepare him for it. And by the way, when he brought, he insisted on controlling all of the writings. And he brought them every day to court in these two giant, old, ancient suitcases. And your listeners who have seen this case on Forensic Files will remember the juror commenting about all the cockroaches we were releasing into that courtroom from these suitcases. And it was a total infestation. Well, the judge mid-trial decided this was too close to his office, so he ordered us to change courtrooms and go into the grand old 1939 era courtroom in the adjacent building, the old courthouse. Well, I was ecstatic because this was the room, the last place Virginia Ridley had been seen, September 15, 1970. And here we are now 29 years, almost 28 and some change years later in that courtroom with her writings. I'm not a real ghost guy, but it was eerie. It was eerie as hell. I was feeling a lot of power and electricity in that room. And of course, Jesus had just shown up to lunch. So,
sure.
I tried to prep Alvin. I took him into the fumigated roach room and put him on the stand and showed him the different perspective, how close he would be to the jury and how he'd be looking in a different direction than he'd been looking the entire trial. And I told him, I explained to him, I said, you know, I've kept some stuff out, like the stuff about your mama, stuff about the cats. If you open the door to your own character, they're going to get that in. And so just please don't say, I would never do that. I'm not that kind of person or anything like that. That's kind of just self-serving.
Right.
And would open up the door. And you know what, Alvin, he listened. I realized that I had not respected Alvin and his abilities most of my life. And I realized that while I was representing them, he was a pretty smart man. His formal education ended after high school. He and my sister graduated. She went on to become a doctor of education, and he went on to be a TV repairman and partially trained by the U.S. Army. He got on the stand, and he was incredible. The juror saw the emotions that he had been accused of never having, but still they were kind of misaligned to what we would expect them to be. But he was charming. But at the same time, I would forget how literal he was. And so I would get ahead of myself and I would say, you know, Mr. Ridley, will you please tell the jury what you've lost? And I was hoping he'd say the love of my life, my best friend. And being very literal, he said, oh, I guess the funeral bill. Well, that the DA just went to town on that and, of course, broke that one off in us in his closing argument. But it was just Alvin was fascinating.
Yes.
And I guess I'll explain now, if viewers haven't read it in the book notes. Only 3 years ago, at the request of a juror from our case 25 years ago, I took Alvin for testing. He is deeply on the autism spectrum.
Right.
And that explains everything. And even I was now more familiar with autism, but I still didn't catch it. 25 years ago, nobody was talking about autism in adults. They were talking about it in children. The idea of a spectrum had just been introduced, it being a spectrum of developmental disorders and developmental disorders. But it explained so much. It explained the flat effect of his voice, which, you know, his autistic mannerisms were literally being used against him at trial. His mismatched or his emotions not always meeting the moment of expectation of emotions. And it made me realize, and I've learned that there are 5.5 million adults walking around out there that have never been diagnosed with autism, that it is estimated that there are that many undiagnosed autistic adults. Now, they are interacting with people every day, and they're interacting with law enforcement and courts every day. And, you know, I've seen judges go off on somebody that they thought was just not engaging or interested in enough in what was going on in court. And so I could see a person with autism getting really bad treatment by the criminal justice system, and with the participants just thinking that they're being difficult or being purposefully evasive, or and what happens, it's a processing issue. And Alvin's processing is just different. It's not better or worse than mine. It's just different than mine. So we're like almost speaking two different languages to each other. So I really, the call to action for the book is for better testing, better recognition, better training of police and inquisitors, and then, of course, of courts. I can't say that I'm certainly glad that we won the case. Alvin was acquitted of all charges. The jury was fascinated with Virginia's writing, and now that it could be explained to them that it was the hypergraphia that compelled her to write, but it didn't affect what she wrote. The minute we walked out of the Catoosa County Courthouse, I thought, this is a hell of a story. But I did not know of the autism component. And I didn't know that until just 3 years ago, 2021. And that finally made it form in my head as a book. I had taken runs at it. I had engaged co-authors because I lacked confidence in my own ability to tell the story. The last person I approached was a writer in California who gave me the confidence to write it myself. She was my developmental editor. Without her, this book wouldn't be here, because she found a curated list of agents. She showed me what a book proposal needed to look like. Her name is Bonnie Hearn Hill. She lives in Fresno, California, and I absolutely owe her the world. She found this curated list of agents, Linda Connor of the Linda Connor Agency in New York City, who had faith in my story. And she found me Michaela Hamilton of Kensington or Citadel. Citadel is an imprint of Kensington, who got excited about the story. And now we are upon publication day. I think on the day this airs, publication day is tomorrow. And twice in the last week and a half, I've been notified by Michaela Hamilton that not only has there been a second printing ordered, and this is all pre-orders, but just today learned, learned that they have upped the number of the second printing. So I really think between the true crime fans of Forensic Files, of American Justice, of Snap Judgment on NPR, people are relating to this story. They liked the story when they heard it in these other forms. And that was before we even knew about Alvin's autism.
Yeah.
Now, Dan, Alvin is just about to turn 82 years old. For the last 25 years, he and I have been lunch companions, very frequent lunch companions. Now it's up to 2 days a week. My secretary and I, my secretary of the last 15 years, used to work with developmentally disabled adults, and she is perfect for Alvin. She helps schedule his Veterans Administration clinic visits. We both make sure he gets there. We got him through cataract surgery. I got him a big ramp built onto his house, which they said was the most difficult ramp build they had ever done at a house because of its topography. And Alvin is having his best life right now. He's a lot calmer. He actually, probably because the community is a lot warmer to him. With his permission, We revealed his autism diagnosis. A lot of people know and love people with autism in their own families, and they see now that in Alvin. And so it's really a story of redemption of a number of people, including a community. And so I'm so appreciative of you having me on to tell about my book, and I would love for your viewers to get it. There's more than one Zenith Man book out there. This is the one with the kissing couple on the cover, and that's Alvin and Virginia.
Right.
That is a photo booth at an amusement park in our community called Lake Winnipesaukee.
Yeah.
And that's a 1965 photo booth, a square that, and there's another photo of them smiling for the camera from the same strip inside the book. So it's just, you know, it's a love letter to my hometown. It's a love letter to my late father. Writing this was cathartic. I feel like a load has been lifted off of me. You know, Maya Angelou said, there's no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside of you. I know exactly how that feels because I've been wanting to tell this story for 25 years.
I want to thank you so much, McCracken Poston for Jr., for coming on and talking about Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. It's been a fascinating interview. For those people that might want to take another look, or do you have a website and do any social media?
Absolutely. McCracken Poston Jr. for Jr.com is my book website. Just plain McCrackenPoston.com is my just Facebook site and law office site, but add the JR to it for the book. On Twitter, it is at Real Zenith Man. And then the other platforms, McCracken Poston Jr., Twitter, Threads, they call it now, Instagram, and all those others. But McCracken Poston Jr. on Facebook is kind of captures everything as well.
Thank you so much, McCracken Poston Jr., for Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. Thank you so much for this interview. You have a great night.
Thank you.
Good night.